On this week's 51%, we speak with Muriel Fox, activist and co-founder of the National Organization for Women, about her new memoir looking back on the second wave of the feminist movement.
Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of women and men began to say, yes, this revolution is long overdue. And each of them worked and fought against what made them mad.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The National Organization for Women, the largest feminist organization in the United States, recently celebrated its 58th birthday. Today, we bring you an interview with one of its co-founders. Muriel Fox is one of the nearly 50 people who founded NOW in 1966 to push for the rights of women alongside its first president, Betty Friedan. Fox, who served as Friedan's main lieutenant, director of operations, and group publicist, says the creation of NOW marks the beginning of the second wave of the feminist movement, which lasted through the 1970s and pushed to give women equal opportunity in the workplace and beyond. Now at age 96, Fox has released a memoir looking back on her time in the movement called The Women's Revolution, How We Changed Your Life. The book celebrates the wave's accomplishments while acknowledging its missteps. Fox says she wanted to provide a comprehensive history of the time from someone who was there. In addition to her own memories, Fox sheds light on 30 men and women, including Friedan, who brought forth instrumental change for women today.
I wrote the book in 1 year at the age of 94, after helping many other people look through my files and writing their books. But I was just getting angry at how many people have never educated women had never heard of Betty Friedan, had never heard of our movement, had never heard of NOW. And I believe history must remember this. And it's, you know, I feel, frankly, I think Betty Friedan belongs with Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi as the leader of a revolution, in our case, as you say, for 51% of the American people. And of course, this is a very exciting time for us to be talking, because we have a woman who may become the next president of the United States, and how Betty would have been so happy to be alive today to see that happen. And that is certainly a result of the women's revolution. And even though we have lost our abortion rights and we still don't have the Equal Rights Amendment, we're never going back to where we were in 1966, when the women's revolution started with the founding of the National Organization for Women, NOW. And then it all began happening very, very fast. I mean, really, when you think thousands of years, women were the subsidiaries of men, were the property of men, and were certainly second-class citizens. Look what we've accomplished in really a very short time.
Well, I think it's worth going back to 1966 and talking about what it was like back then. You know, something that I didn't know growing up is that women weren't even allowed to apply for and own a credit card on their own until like 1974.
You're absolutely right. And people your age don't believe that the ads used to say help wanted male, help wanted female, and that it was legal for an employer to say we don't hire women, or for a restaurant to say we don't admit women, or a labor union, a law school, a medical school, a business school to say we don't admit women. Now, of course, not only is that illegal, but it's unthinkable. And half the, more than half of the college students and the professional students in advanced schools are women. It's a very exciting time to be a woman.
Well, tell me a little bit more about your experience in the movement and what were you doing around that time that brought you to it?
Well, I was the deputy to Betty Friedan, who really was the founder of our movement. I was a co-founder of NOW, and I was the public relations specialist who told the media of the world about this new women's movement. I was vice president of what was then the world's largest public relations agency, Carl Bayer. And incidentally, when I applied to Carl Bayer for the first time, I was sent away. They said, we don't hire women. We don't hire women writers. Sure, we had secretaries, but no women in executive posts. And I went away and took another job, but then I heard about an opening in the radio and television department at Carl Bayer, and I was told that the head of that department was more open, and he did hire me, and I ended up as executive vice president of the agency, which incidentally, it was an executive vice president of the agency who had told me we don't hire women.
I guess, what do you view as some of the most important aspects of the movement? You know, for the accomplishments that you made, where do you credit your success?
Well, we had a lot of very smart professionals in it, and they did a good job. But what happened, frankly, to our surprise, was that overnight, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of women and men began to say, yes, this revolution is long overdue. And each of them worked and fought against what made them mad. In my case, for instance, women not being allowed to have lunch at the Plaza Hotel's Oak Room. So I organized a picket of the Oak Room. And each woman did something in her field, in her job, in her labor union, in her university, in her community to make a difference. And I think that's really why we succeeded so fast. Really, it was very fast. I also have to say another reason. I did some research recently and learned that all these fabulous laws that we got passed were all passed with a Congress that was entirely Democratic, House and Senate. And I don't know if maybe we would have succeeded so well if we didn't have both halves of the Senate, of Congress. And I think that's a lesson for people today. They really have to work on politics. This is the year, this is the season now for everyone to work on politics at all levels, not just national Congress, but local legislatures, local school boards. Politics is the answer right now.
You set out to recognize 29 women and one man for their contributions to the movement, including some people that history may not remember as well. Would you like to highlight any of them for us?
Well, there were every one of these, you know, I tried to reduce the number. I thought 30 was too many, but every one of them made such a difference that I had to leave them in. And they're names that the world should never forget. I mean, oh, we'll take the one man. His name was Phineas Idris. He got us the law that prevented employers from firing a woman because of pregnancy. And he also overcame, he was a lawyer, the law in several states where women who were convicted of a crime got a longer sentence than the men because, quote, women were considered harder to rehabilitate. Can you imagine that today? They got longer sentences in jail. And so, you know, Phineas Idris deserves to be remembered by history as much as Patrick Henry, some of the men who are remembered.
In the book, you talk a lot about your work with Betty Friedan. You say, you know, she was the mother of the movement, but you also describe her as that, quote, maddening, astounding woman, end quote. You know, over the years, Friedan's, I guess, legacy has been looked at with a little bit more of a complicated lens, you know, for being difficult to work with and calling lesbians the, quote, lavender menace. What was it like working with Betty?
It was very difficult. Betty Friedan was, I would say, impossible to work with. She had a terrible temper, and she just had many personal flaws as a human being. But I said in some interviews after her death, well, maybe it takes angry people to make revolutions. And she was an angry, hostile woman, but she was the one who did it. We all agree. Betty is the one who did it. She gave us our name, National Organization for Women Now. She gave us our wonderful statement of purpose. She was the president of NOW for the first 4 years. She gave us our strategies. And I hope everybody will remember. So when I say, have you ever heard of Betty Friedan? They'll say, yes, she changed the world.
What do you think she was most angry about back then? I guess what drove her?
Well, really, I would say our revolution at the beginning was mostly about jobs. Women just turned away from jobs. They couldn't get into the door. They couldn't get promoted. They certainly didn't get the same salary as men. And we had to get the laws not only passed, but we had to get them enforced. And we marched and we protested and we had lawsuits. And we put every possible pressure on the government to make it illegal and enforceable that you cannot tell a woman we don't hire women.
You've mentioned that this book also endeavors to, I guess, correct some mistakes that you feel historians have made regarding second wave feminism. What do you view as some of those mistakes?
Well, I think, first of all, some very reputable historians got it wrong about Betty Friedan and didn't understand she was the one who did it. I think the historians, when they looked through the records, they didn't like Betty Friedan. She was not likable, but she was the guiding force. And also the issue of lesbians is a good example. We evolved. You know, we were this new young movement after thousands of years. So we had a lot to learn. And at the beginning, we did not think that the lesbian issue was a feminist issue. We thought it was an important civil rights issue, but not our issue. And then we evolved and we learned that it is part of the movement. But a lot of historians got it wrong, and some of our earliest battles they called lesbian purges, which they were not. They were just discussion, very heated arguments. And some lesbians left because they felt we didn't have the right attitude. We didn't. And we learned. But the lesbians who stayed in NOW came to have important positions and are very valued, and it's part of the movement. And we're just learning, you know, we're asking questions about the trans movement now. And we don't know what the answers are always. We're really just beginning to learn about what is a woman, what is a relationship, and we're going to learn a lot. And that's where you young people have to get involved.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, second wave feminism has gotten criticism over the years for not being more intersectional, for not serving women of color as much, or LGBTQ plus women. I guess, what do you make of this analysis looking back?
We were a revolutionary movement and we had a lot to learn and we were working it out. And we made a lot of mistakes and we fought with each other. And I regret those battles. We could have gotten much further if we hadn't fought so bitterly, frankly, but we did. And I think anyone who criticizes us for not doing it all at the beginning has to understand we were a revolution. We had to change the world. We had to change people's ideas. We had to change minds. Consciousness raising was a very important part of our movement so that women, especially, could understand how their lives were governed by oppression and by ideas that were wrong. And we had to learn that. So I think anyone who criticizes us for not doing it all right at the beginning fails to understand how difficult it was.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about that concept of consciousness raising. You know, what exactly is it and how do you do it?
Well, it's a small group of women sitting together, talking about their life. And, you know, someone might say, my boss calls me my girl. Can you imagine that? And I have a better education than he has. My husband expects me to do all the housework and cleaning, even though I work just as hard as he does at a paid job. And we had to understand that this is not doesn't have to be that way. And so this raised our consciousness about things that had been taken for granted for thousands of years, and we no longer take them for granted.
You said earlier that you believe politics is where the women's rights movement should be focusing today. But are there any other areas that you feel that, we still need to work on that the second wave wasn't able to tackle?
The most important one is childcare. I mean, this country lags behind Zimbabwe. I mean, all the other developed countries are so far ahead of America in providing childcare. And until society understands that it's a job for all of us to raise our children and call it early childhood education, until that happens, women can't really take their place because, frankly, we have still the largest part of the job of childcare. And society must take its responsibility for childcare very seriously. When, in 1971, we got a wonderful childcare bill passed, but Richard Nixon vetoed it. And we still have to work. Elizabeth Warren has worked very hard for childcare. She understands, she tells us how important it was in her life and enabling her to have a career. And this is so important. So this is absolutely an issue we have to work on.
Well, Muriel, thanks so much for speaking with me. Do you have any advice for feminists and advocates today?
I think I want them, I hope, people who read my book will understand how difficult it was and how hard, but we overcame just the way the other aspects of the civil rights movement overcame some, not all, and how much improvement we can still bring to the world by overcoming. And I hope when people read that book, they understand and they'll want to get involved. And that's why I'm so excited when people buy my book and they want it for other girls, young girls in their family, to understand what we all went through.
Muriel Fox is a former public relations executive, feminist activist, and co-founder of the National Organization for Women. Her new memoir on the second wave feminist movement is called The Women's Revolution: How We Changed Your Life. It's out now through New Village Press, and you can find it at most major booksellers. Muriel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jesse.
The Summer Olympics are underway in Paris. While many reporters and sports fans are focused on the games themselves, reporter Rose Eveleth has been looking back on the long history of sexual division in elite sports. In their new series, Tested, a collaboration between NPR's Embedded and the CBC, Eveleth follows the story of multiple elite runners who have been told they can no longer run as women because of their biology, and takes a hard look at how sports organizations determine who can and cannot compete.
I'm a sports nerd and a science journalist, and also someone who loves to crawl into a historical rabbit hole. And what I pretty quickly realized is that this story intersects with all of those things. Because it turns out that sports organizations have been on a century-long pursuit to find a singular, foolproof exam or test that can determine, without a doubt, whether an athlete is female.
Eveleth recently spoke with WAMC News Director Ian Pickus.
So, I understand you've been interested in this topic for quite a while. What sparked your interest in the first place?
Yeah, well, I'm a sports nerd, as you just heard. I've always loved sports, played sports, and I'm also a science journalist. And I was an intern at Scientific American many years ago. I think it was 2012. And I was actually researching something different. I had been writing about advanced prosthetics. And I was researching this very interesting case of Oscar Pistorius, who at the time was in the news a lot because he was trying to race against able-bodied athletes. He's a double amputee. And the question was, like, does he have an unfair advantage because he's got these, you know, specialized blades for legs? And in doing that research, I came across this other story of Caster Semenya, who was a different South African runner who was also accused of having an unfair advantage for a very different reason. In 2009, she sort of burst onto the world stage, won a very dramatic race in Berlin, and people started saying things about her body and about her sex and that maybe she was somehow not really a woman, and that gave her this unfair advantage. And I remember just thinking, like, what? Like, what does that mean? Like, when people say that, like, what are they talking about? And I got kind of obsessed from there. And I've been sort of following the story since then, essentially. I, you know, had heard of Caster in 2009 when it happened, but I hadn't really dug deep until that moment in my internship as a wee baby science reporter at Scientific American.
Well, with respect to some of the athletes who are profiled in this series, can you help us understand the terms? Because I think a lot of people will have, you know, followed news stories about fights, about, you know, which kinds of competitions women can participate in and so on. But this isn't exactly, you know, the culture war question about trans people at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is a little confusing. And some argue, I think, that it has been intentionally muddied, perhaps. But there are the athletes that I'm following are not trans athletes. These are women who were assigned female at birth, have always been raised as girls, lived as women, have never, in fact, questioned their sex or gender until they were tested by, you know, the organizing body, or tested by doctors as at the request of the organizing body for track and field. And, you know, the terminology can be confusing. There are some folks who use the word intersex. There are some folks who use the word DSD, which stands for differences of sex development. Some people say, you know, variations in sex biology. There's kind of a lot of different terms that people use here. And it just sort of means people who don't fall super, super neatly into the kind of sex biology that maybe we learned about in high school, right? The like X, 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 Y, all sort of lined up in a row in terms of your sex biology. And that variation, it's hard to pin down exactly how common it is. It sort of depends on how you define it. But some people estimate that people with sex variations defined broadly are about 1 to 2% of the population. So it's not incredibly rare.
And I know that this is the heart of the question you set out to answer, but who ultimately, like when we talk about the Olympics of this year or in years past, sort of gets to decide where the line is?
Yeah, the sporting bodies themselves get to decide where the line is. And they have been deciding where the line is since women were allowed to compete in the Olympics, you know, in the early 1900s. Women on the track were not allowed onto the track until 1928 at the Olympics. And so there's the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, they run the Olympics, and then each sport has their federation. So World Athletics is the track and field federation, World Aquatics for swimming, you know, every sport has their own. And for a long time, the IOC and World Athletics were sort of in step with one another. They have diverged since around 2014, 2015, they've kind of diverged. But the sporting federations themselves get to decide. So different sports have different rules. World Athletics has rules that are different from, you know, gymnastics or soccer or, you know, these other organizations. And it makes it a little bit confusing, I think, sometimes, because it's a bit hodgepodge. And it's, you know, enforcement is, you know, hard because it's there's lots of people who play sports. You know, there's lots of people around the world who have different rules. And so right now, there is a lot of variety, actually, in the rules and the line that is drawn between who gets to compete in the women's category, you know, with no restrictions, and who has restrictions on their competition and their participation.
So for the athletes you focused on, what have been some of the implications of having been subjected to this sex testing?
Yeah, so right now the policy impacts some athletes with some kinds of sex variations, and they have been presented with this very difficult choice. Basically, their choice is they can choose to comply with the rules, which means that they will have to lower their naturally occurring testosterone level down to a set number. And to do that requires either, in some cases, surgery, in other cases, medication that has, you know, obviously known side effects that Caster has talked about at length. And if they don't want to do that, they can no longer compete at the elite level in the women's category. Now, the rules actually say that these women could technically compete in the male category, which I think many of them find quite offensive because they're not men. And also just practically, I mean, people talk about these women dominating and you know, running these incredible times, but they would not be competitive in the male category. These are not, Caster does not even have the world record for the women in the 800 meters. Neither does Christine Boma, who I follow around for this series. So, you know, these are not women who are performing, you know, at male qualifying times.
So for the 1-2% of people who fall into this category, I mean, what would they do? Where should they compete?
I mean, this is where we get into opinion, right? Like, I believe that, you know, you should compete as the sex and gender that you are. I feel that is what is correct. Other folks think, no, you know, there should be some sort of line that we're drawing to kind of decide who can compete with restrictions, who can compete without restrictions, who can't compete at all. Right now, trans women cannot compete at all in track and field, according to World Athletics regulations. But this is where you get into, you know, these are rules that are decided by each sport. And it sort of gets into this sort of bigger question of what you think fairness is and what is fair to you. And I think that is, unfortunately, or fortunately, perhaps, depending on how you think about it, a subjective decision. And I think a lot of people in this story really want this to be a science question, that like science is going to answer this for us. It's going to, you know, tell us exactly what to do. And science can tell you many things, but it actually can't tell you what is fair, right? It can't tell you what is right or just or equitable or all those things that we hope and, you know, wish that the world and sports could be. And so I think it's tough. You know, you hear different athletes reacting differently. Some of them decide to take the medication and try to play by the rules. Some of them have decided to fight and take the organizing body for track and field to court, the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Many of them have given up. I've heard stories about younger athletes being discouraged from entering into sports because they know, like the adults know, that they're going to run into these problems. And so we're sort of steering those athletes away from sports, which to me as a sports lover is really sad. So it's tough. It's a really tough question.
What will you be watching for with this reporting project now behind you in the Olympics?
Yeah. None of the athletes that I followed were able to make it to the Olympics. That is perhaps a mini spoiler for the show, but it's known. So I think it's hard. It's interesting to watch the Olympics knowing that these women who want to be there and by some rights should be there aren't. You know, I think in sports and in so many things, we only talk about the people who are there, right? People who are racing. It's so easy to be forgotten. And so it's going to be, I think, bittersweet for me being at the Olympics and watching the races and, you know, being excited for those who win and also just always thinking about those who weren't given the opportunity and aren't there.
That was Rose Eveleth speaking with WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. Tested is a collaboration between NPR's Embedded and the CBC. You can listen in wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King from 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet.